Hello, you're listening to a spoiler-filled film conversation. Hooray!
Evil under the sun. Hello, welcome to Spoilerville Film Conversation. Hooray. I'm Richard. With me for this week's podcast is Anthony
Hello.
and Abby.
Hello.
In the summertime, where the weather is fine, there's a murder mystery and it's gotta be solved by a fat Belgian man, played by Peter Ustinov today. Thank you.
That's very good.
I'm not a singer. I'm not available for dates.
So, but you are a lyricist, it seems, Richard.
My ad lib skills are level two. Anyway, yeah, we're doing a murder mystery, guys. Oh my god, who did it? Ooh. Anyway, obviously, at some point during the podcast, and I'm not necessarily going to say when, we're going to spoil who did this murder mystery. But that is our want here at Spoiler Filled. We're always talking about films in detail, and that requires telling you what happened in them, even the bits that are supposed to be left till the end. So you're warned.
Which is slightly more problematic this time around, considering it's everything is in the spoilers with like a mystery like.
But
But
then,
you there's your warning, guys.
yeah, it's felt like a needed one, even though the title of our show sort of gives you a clue every time. But yeah, it was your pick, Anthony. You wanted us to do an Agatha Christie, so do you want to give us the details and then explain yourself?
I will. Okay, so this week we watched Evil Under the Sun, which was released in 1982, and is one of the hundreds of film adaptations of the work of Agatha Christie on film, TV, radio, whatever. And this particular film is the second outing of Peter Ustinov playing her famous Belgian detective Hercule Poirot. Who is off on his exotic adventures again this time around, stumbling onto a murder on a small Adriatic holiday island whilst investigating an insurance fraud. This film was directed by Guy Hamilton, who is most known as director of quite a few of the Bond films, most notably Goldfinger, and also some of the lesser ones, which we won't go into. It has a screenplay adapted by Anthony Schaefer, who's done a lot of mystery writing for stage and screen, and is also the brother of Peter Schaefer, who is the writer of one of our spoiler-filled favourites, Amadeus.
Very well informed.
As with most Agatha Christie stories, the film has a huge cast, which includes Peter Ustinov, as mentioned, Diana Rigg, Maggie Smith, Dennis Quealy, Emily Hone, Nicholas Clay, Jane Birkin, Roddy McDowall, James Mason, sorry, terrible impression, Sylvia Miles, and Colin Blakely.
And you picked it because.
I picked it because I will be in, I will be in a murder mystery myself soon.
Because I got to kill again.
Me and a local theatre group are doing a kind of like dinner murder mystery thing. And I wanted to kind of get in the mood by looking up some Agatha Christie, I suppose. In particular, this one, because it has a few notes which are similar to the murder mystery I'll be doing.
So the idea
And
is,
we've never done Agatha Christie before.
no, we haven't, and there's quite a wealth of them, as you already said. So the idea is you're going to be in a, like, it seems like you live in the life of characters from Frasier, and people are going to pay money to eat vol-au-vents and try and discern which actor is the real murderer in something. You're going to, you're a character who's going to give contextual dialogue to a murder mystery. How enlighten the listeners and ourselves how this works.
Well, yeah, pretty much, you're right. It's just kind of like a little play kind of going on around a dinner party, like a three-course dinner party. And the guests are allowed to come up to us and kind of ask us questions to kind of work out what what's going on. Clues will be handed out at points, and at the end, everyone has to see if they can guess who it is.
Mm. So people are like half chewing like a duck leg and be like, "So, how did you meet your fiance then?" And do you sort of make up an answer? Is that, am I imagining it right?
Yeah, I suppose. I've never done one before, so...
If people enter into the spirit and become actors themselves, or if they just pick their nose and sort of put up with it as an entertainment form. Well, that's exciting. And why? What better way to do your homework than to needlessly evaluate a perfectly serviceable mystery with us?
my thoughts exactly.
Abby, how are you at your? What are your feelings on Agatha Christie and her the things that have been adapted from her work?
Well, the only ones I'm sure that I've seen are David Suchet's ones on telly.
Hmm.
I mean, he is the, when you think Poirot, it's hard not to envision David Suchet because he makes the role his own and has done so many in the past.
Yeah, especially in like in my head, he's very ubiquitous as Poirot, and I was very aware of that at the beginning of this film, watching Peter Ustinov, and just being like, "Well, you're not Poirot, are you?" But I will step in early and praise him, because by the end, I think he really did make it his own, which is a tough feat, considering how well like ingrained David Suchet has become in the role.
Yeah, that is a factor. When I was a child, I quite liked Poirot mysteries. My mum liked them, I'd watch them. And when the films would come on, I'd be like, "What? Who's this guy? Who's this grey-haired bloke?" And like subsequently, I love Peter Ustinov. I like he's really great in Spartacus, and then he turns up other places, like the crazy cat man in Logan's Run. And whenever he turns up, he has like such a delicious like accent and way of talking. He's such a perfect smarmy person. And I think he's a very talented actor and a very enjoyable screen presence. So it's weird trying to balance out, "Oh, you're not Poirot, but I love you, Peter Ustinov. You're so good. Your words are like syrup. So sickly sweet and brilliant." So yeah, that's my thoughts. Barbie, you had seen this or you hadn't, did you say?
I hadn't seen this one. I don't think I've actually seen any of Ustinov's turns as Poirot.
But do murder mysteries grab you? Are they something you can sort of put on and enjoy, or do they sort of, you know? Because Agatha Christie's, she makes a very certain style of mystery, but she's pretty much the template for the genre.
It all depends on the presentation, which we'll get into later with this specifically, and how much they regurgitate things to explain.
Yeah, that is something. Like, a thriller will take you on a journey, whereas a murder mystery has to sort of lay out characters, and it's partly there to make you guess or be... You're meant to change your view and judgments on characters as you get to know more information, a bit like you would if you were presumably a detective asking questions. But yeah, it's an odd voyeuristic approach to the detective novel, isn't it? It's you're like a anonymous viewer of the case, and then the end comes and you're either satisfied, frustrated, or blown away or whatever.
And the trailer that they put out where he was talking directly down camera to the audience was just fucking weird.
I liked it. I liked the fact
that me too.
That Peter Ustinov is about to eat a decadent trifle, like he does in the film. He has the trifle in the film, which is good, but he just directly says, "Maybe, you know, you want to come along on this hot holiday journey murder mystery and try and work it out with me. See if you can best Poirot." And then they have the trailer where all the scenes that might tempt you to watch it happen. And you cut back and he's finished the trifle. And I kind of like that as a way to talk to you about... It's like almost like a little personal advert at you, which is different to a usual trailer.
Yeah, that's why I liked it, just because it's, you know, it tried something different, and I was happy with that.
It challenged you, which is odd. Like, oh, do you think you fucking solve it? And I was like, oh, maybe I can. I watched a few Agatha Christies. I know that it's never the people you think it is at the beginning. It's always the quiet ones. And you can pretty much flip a coin whether it's going to be a butler or not, so... Yeah. I don't know. I was ready for this. I wasn't put off by the fact that there's loads and they're kind of interchangeable after a while. Like, I asked my mum, like, had she seen it? Because I saw her today and I was saying we're doing Evil Under the Sun. And she was like, oh, is it the one where the man is... the rich man is murdered? I was like, no. No, an actress... Oh, wait, well, that's going to be the film. We can spoil it. But she couldn't get to what film it was because she'd seen so many. And she said herself, like, I can never remember who did them. I just find them familiar when I watch them, if I've seen them before. And I'm still like, was it this guy? I don't know. So, yeah.
I kind of understand that feeling, actually, yeah.
And Agatha Christie has tropes and styles that happen again. I mean, the very fact that these detectives or people who solve the mystery, they might not be detectives initially, but they always happen to be where the murder is. It's not like Poirot, at least, is called in a lot of the times as a specialist because he's a famous detective a la like Sherlock Holmes or something. So, but it's the people like Miss Marple or what's her name, Murder, She Wrote, just writing her books happens to be by a murder. And it's like, oh, fuck off, mate. You probably did this. Which is the obvious solution to any of the murders she wrote, is she did it. And she's come up with a very, you know, flimsy excuse that someone has admitted to. But, I don't know. I always think she's done it. Angela Lansbury. Bitch. No, I love her. She's great. Never mind. Anyway.
Yes.
This one.
What kind of tone were you... What kind of tone do you guys associate with, like, Agatha Christie? Because the more obvious one is kind of dramery thriller kind of tone. But I've seen like a lot of stuff, especially like Miss Marple, kind of like old black and white Miss Marple films, that really leaned heavily on comedy.
Yeah, I don't...
So is that like an impression that you guys get? Because I've always got the kind of... Thinking of Agatha Christie, it's sometimes it could be like a really light-hearted comedy. I don't know if you guys ever expect that from Agatha Christie.
I've seen it in a couple. It is sort of... I think what the makers try and do is because a lot of the time it's about murder and deception and generally nasty business, they try and put the jokes in where they can. And sometimes it's just a bit weird.
Yeah, I think the thing with an Agatha Christie is... The murder is never scary or grisly. I mean, they might have done something horrible, but it's always with a... There's a lightness to it. It's never serious. Like, if someone's murdered, that should be horrible. They should... The thing that's kind of wrong with this film is when the victim is murdered, there's no sense of bereaving and a sensitive period of time while people get over their loss. Like, no one gives a fuck at all. There's not even that much of a hint of, oh, we should probably respect the dead here. I mean, admittedly, in this, the character's not liked very much, but there's, like, basically, there's a husband who's, like, at no point does he cry, look sad, or even react to the fact that his wife's murdered. He's just standing about being a suspect, and it's just, what? We're not having any sort of... I mean, there's nothing to do with the body being dealt with. It's mentioned, but there's no sense of... Death is real and sad, you know.
I suppose it's a kind of black comedy in that kind of way.
Yeah, I guess they are. They're light considering the topic is quite serious. Usually, like a murder is usually quite harrowing or sad, or you know. But the whole point of it, the vibe I usually expect from an Agatha Christie, I guess, to answer your question, is usually it's the 20s or something. You know, it's always like a period drama, I guess, because. You know, kind of when she was from and when she was writing about. And so I always expect it, I almost associate the era of the 20s and 30s as not just Art Deco and avant-garde fashion, but, and like, you know, people, it's not just people dancing the Charleston and stuff, it's people getting murdered, and then everyone stands about it, sort of discussing alibis.
Being okay about it. Yeah.
It's like that's when all the fancy murdering went on, is that period of time. And that sort of tethered to it because of Agatha. But yeah, I guess they are a little bit funny, now you mention it.
They don't take themselves
seriously.
Yeah, this film has a couple of like comedy like flourishes throughout.
I want to particularly bring up Peter Ustinov swimming.
Oh my god, so funny.
Like, first of all, what the fuck is he wearing? Second of all, what the fuck is he doing? It's
just... Yeah, I'm so glad. I mean, this should be the first point, because it's A, the best joke, and you're right, there's a lot of fashion in this. You go, Christ, what are they wearing?
Oh my god, the suits. Jesus.
Maggie Smith is in some interesting numbers as well. It's not just the... there's a gay sailor-y bloke. I mean, I think he's just... he's a screenplay... No, he's a novelist, isn't he? A writer, I guess. And he's a bit vaguely camp. And he dresses up like a cute sailor some of the time. But outside of that, Poirot, when he goes swimming, I mean, obviously... You know, it's the 20s or whatever, so the swimming costumes are a bit more there's a bit more coverage, and luckily for Peter Ustinov, he doesn't have to go like bare-chested, but he does wear a swimming cap, but it's a red orangey beret, and then like a black kind of, how would you even describe a swimming costume, but like from neck to kind of short length
item. Yeah, it's all the way down to his knees,
and he makes a big fuss about going swimming, and then when he's unobserved, he goes in, like, to his shins. And because it's, I don't know, too cold for him, or Poirot's a bit of a puss, he pretends to swim back and forth in the shallows. And I love the bit later where someone asks him, did you go swimming? And they're just, because they could see him in his swimming costume. And he's like, did you see me? And the guy goes, no, I just, you know, did you? Then yes, I went swimming, not acting like a brat on the beach. So that was amazing and the best thing.
All of the fashion would normally be in black and white, and to see it in colour was absolutely horrendous. The other thing was at the start when he was talking to the insurance guy, and the insurance guy was wearing his glasses hanging off one ear.
I'm glad someone else noticed that, because
that was brilliant. But yeah, I just wanted to bring up those two little points, because they wouldn't have been worth bringing up later. Just the endless parade of hats. I love hats, but all of the hats in this were so fugly and weird. And there was one of the women's wearing a dress. One of the other women said, "That dress is beautiful." And I wanted to go back in time and slap her.
I remember. Oh, God.
Yeah, there's a tacky vibe to a lot of it. The one that struck me was a particularly good hat was the actress who the plot revolves around for a while. She wore a kind of Chinese style red kind of fashion, like a not like a, you know, one that you'd be picking rice with, like, but like that idea, like a conical hat, the red and a little bit more like you're going to like Ascot or something. And she put it on her face while she was sunbathing, and I was like, that's got a mesh, you're gonna get like a patchy suntan. Like, you're gonna get the weirdest tan lines on your face if you wear that. Luckily she got garroted, so she had a
least of her problems.
Yeah. Her neck being broke is more of an issue. Think of the horrible line you get across your neck. That's not going to look good, is it? Open casket. Anyway, yes. I mean, the fashion is a buffet for the eyes. And here at Spoilerfield, we're always a big fan of garish, weird costumes. And this provides them. So I'm very grateful for that. It's a weird one where... The actress who does everyone's nut in, basically, throughout the start of the film, she turns up and she's wearing a dress that has the like, same pattern as the host of, like, the... Maggie Smith plays the woman who is the landlord or host of the hotel. Did you host a hotel? Mm-hmm. Host cocktails. She was, like, the patron of the hotel. And she had this spotted, like, colourful hat on. And then this woman comes in with a dress that basically looks the same. And I was wondering if she was, like, deliberately trying to upstage her, or if it was just a coincidence of fashion or something.
I wouldn't be surprised, because having both Diana Rigg and Maggie Smith as kind of antagonizing characters was just perfect. Yeah. Like, no one does kind of like bitchy just quite like they did in this.
Spot on, yeah. And, like, the idea is they're rivals in the plot. Because they like Maggie Smith owns a hotel. What was the island in? I'm not actually 100% what region of the world we're in. Sunny tropical.
It's not a real place. It's called Tyrannia, but it's not a real place.
And yet the British, who have presumably colonized it and run hotels there, are still racist towards a fictional race of people who are shit at housekeeping and being hotel staff in general. But that's just like good observations about horrible British people who run gaffes abroad. So Maggie Smith was what was interesting about Maggie Smith is she's been that old lady actor for so long. It was refreshing to see in the 80s when she was a bit younger and actually had ginger hair and like wasn't just a bitch old lady. She was slightly bitchy, but you know, relatable host character, and I liked how she was trying to sleuth with Poirot. In fact, I think she got the murderer right before Poirot. It's just she took it back later when she heard more story. So she correctly guessed that it was like the woman. Isn't that right? She looked at the map. She had like a little 3D representation of the island, and she suggested the correct person. Isn't that right?
Yeah. No, but she said the wife before she made the mini map.
Yeah, well, she was.
She said the mini map.
Well, we can't, you know.
To be fair, though, I'm pretty sure she did implicate pretty much everyone at some point.
That kind of, yeah, she did start ruling, like she did start ruling out people and suggesting others. But I was a bit like remembering it, going, oh, she pretty much nailed it from like before Poirot. That's the main thing. But yeah, so I sent, you know, I'll sort of sum up the gist, because we're not going to endlessly talk about how the plot unfolded and what the thing was. But essentially, so the opener was like a murder on the moors of Scotland or something that was a mystery. And then we instantly go, ah, fuck being in more rainy.
Yeah.
This is evil under the sun, motherfucker. So cut to, like, Poirot is sent there to sort of figure out for an insurance company a really boring diamond-based fraud mystery that had someone strangled. And it was like, oh, okay. Poirot's on the holiday and he's going to have a lovely swim, sort of, and solve something. But, crucially, we had an actor woman, or a retired actress, and her new husband, and then his daughter and her stepdaughter, who she didn't like, and the father adored, and that was kind of a little family horrible dynamic that was interesting. Who else do we have, guys?
There was like the younger couple, who Patrick and Christine Redfern, played by Nicholas Clay and Jane Birkin, who, and it turns out like the Patrick is the lover of Diana Rigg's character,
or at least was potentially going to be. Like, there's a suggestion that he might not actually be the lover, but, you know, he's up for it, and she might be as well. Like, it may have just been potential rather than confirmed, isn't it?
There's also Odell Gardner and Myra Gardner, played by James Mason and Sylvia Miles, who are kind of like a husband and wife theatre-producing team, I think. And they have been jilted in the past by Diana Rigg.
Is the idea that they wanted her to be in one of their films and she just refused? Is that why they kind of a bit miffed with her?
Something like that. I think she like walked out halfway through a production of some like a Broadway show that they were producing or something.
Yeah.
And now they've got something new for her to look at, but she's resistant. Yeah. And there's also Rex Brewster, played by Roddy McDowall, who is the kind of camp sailor suit wearing journalist/critic.
Yeah, crucially, he wants to write a slightly salacious biography about her, and she's read it and has told him to go fuck himself. You're not making money off of scandal involving me. And he's rather put out by that.
And the last character is Sir Horace Blatt, played by Colin Blakely, who is the guy, like the insurance
diamond
guy, yeah, who's being investigated. But he's also a suspect because he turns up just as the murder's taking place, and it turns out that it's Diana Riggs' character that he gave the diamond to and subsequently got exchanged for a fake.
Yeah, he's like a tiny, is he sort of just working class English man with a little Hitler moustache?
Well, working class background, but has subsequently come into lots of money since.
Yeah, no, he's rich. He's got a boatload of alibis with him or something as well. Just hunky desk hands who are watching him move that can vouch for when he's not committing murders or whatever.
Mm.
Yeah, so, you know, I guess we should rewind a bit and talk about some of the goings on before there's a murder. And then, because there's basically, I would say, three sections. Who are all these people? Part one. Mm. And then part two is, oh fuck, there's going to be a murder, probably of the woman who's winding everyone up so they can all have reasons to, like, motivation to kill her. And then part three, who done it? And then, and yeah, then I guess a little addendum. I guess part four is gather around in the living room so I can explain it all. Like, that's kind of that's sort of part three, but it's like an addendum, really, to confirm everything. Would you guys agree that's kind of what we had, and that is often the formula?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, this is a tried and tested Agatha Christie formula. Like, I'm sure she's written it hundreds of times.
I feel like they were a little bit heavy-handed with it in this, though. Yeah, it was very much like, and now we do this bit where he's all, but this, but that, but this, but that, but this, but that, but this. They're a bit heavy-handed with the formula in this one. They didn't even try and just dress it up a bit. But then I don't know, because this was, what, 1982? I don't know if it'd actually been done that many times for it to feel tired yet.
That's true.
Theatre plays often do it, though. Like, you know, I think the murder mystery is well established and formulaic. That's not really a problem I have. I mean, it's a little bit... The thing that was the most jarring is how... We sort of mentioned it, but it's just jarring to see everyone not give a fuck that someone's dead. And I guess that relates to the first point, which is they have to set up the murder victim or, you know, set the stage for a murder. And the way they do that is very blunt as well, because it's basically this retired actress woman comes with her husband and stepdaughter into the hotel where everyone's going to be staying and goes, "Hello, I'm the biggest bitch in the world. Now react to me, darlings."
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was pretty signposted earlier on. It's like, well, she's going to die then, isn't she?
We want her to die by the end of her segment. But every person comes along. Like, Maggie Smith is like, "Ah, yes, I remember you from those days, and I'm going to say everything with a sort of..." Like, what's the line she says about, "I hope you have a restful peace"? Like, she basically says RIP to her. And there's a little back and forth. "Oh, well, my husband can take the bags up if your staff are shit." "No, they'll do it. Don't... you bitch." And then the actress is like, "Oh, must be shit being hostess of a shitty hotel, you bint." And then obviously Maggie Smith has to, like, "Yeah, well, fuck you too, fuck." Like, so every character comes along and has reason to want this actress woman dead. Were there any ones that stood out? I mean, obviously the teenage girl is a classy it's a particularly good interaction, and maybe the writer guy. Does anyone want to talk about some of the people who hate her and how and why?
With the writer, Rex Brewster, played by Roger McDowall, What is he going for as a thing?
Hello, Sailor, I believe, is the look he's going for. What is the deal? Is it like No, it's not. It's post-YMCA, so sailors are established as a gay icon. I mean, they had the In the Navy song, The Village People. They also did that. So, I don't know.
No, but this is set in the past.
So they haven't... Are sailors intrinsically linked to homosexuality?
It's not even that so much. It's just his manner was so... No one is like this. Nobody.
Fakely positive, isn't he? He's like... I guess he's trying to butter her up. So he's like, oh, darling, you're brilliant. I'm so glad to see you. Let's cut to the chase. I need you to sign off on this tantalising book. And then she, you know, doesn't just say no. She, you know, is nice to him and then tells him to go fuck himself, and she absolutely won't let it happen. And he pouts then, I guess, from then on. But I don't know, like, his dressing gown and sailor hat thing is sort of baffling.
Yeah, but I kind of give him credit, specifically Roddy McDowall, for just trying something else for a change. Because usually, like, if you see him in a film, he's just usually the same kind of boring character.
That's so true, actually.
It's the flounce about a bit more.
Yeah. So I can see that he's doing something that he's not usually... that he doesn't usually do.
He obviously wants to look good to the stepmother. So he's sort of... I don't know, he keeps telling the teenage girl... Oh, you know, no need to be a pouting, slaggy emo bitch about it all the time. He has a really good phrase about, didn't anyone tell you, don't be such a fucking moody cow, it's not becoming, or something. Do you remember that line? It was more succinct than my version.
I don't...
Peevish? I think he says peevish isn't becoming, or something.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not so sure, though, because, like, there's so many lines... Or like witty lines in this film, like you're just bombarded with them constantly. I can't really distinguish them from each other.
Well, if there isn't bickering in funny ways, it's buttering each other up. There's lots of, like, Maggie Smith is buttering up Poirot because she doesn't want a scandal when the murder is revealed. Then you've got the actress, obviously, is talked to nicely by her husband, and also. The person she's having an affair with doesn't need to be complimentary because he's topless in trunks and is handsome, so he could just jet off with her in a boat. But there's a lot of people, you know, infighting and having to have put downs and funny lines in it. So
I need to find out if that guy is Irish or Irish.
Yeah, I was like, what's this with his voice? And I didn't know until right at the end. I think he uses the word Blarney or something. And I'm like, oh, so he is meant to be Irish.
Because he sounds more American at times as well. I don't know what he's doing.
Yeah, he's got that kind of Christopher Lambert. It's like, I don't know what you're doing, but it's weird.
he's English. So, you know, he had a fighting chance. But, no, he's not Irish. He's Irish. I'd like to talk about that song that was that sort of... It tried to do a lot for subtext, but was just sort of weird. Like, baby, you're the... Because it was...
Don't let me... No, no, do sing the song. Go on.
It was like, baby, if I'm the bottom, then you're the top. That one. And just, it was so...
Oh, yeah,
we didn't need this song to know that you're a bitch and everyone hates you. We knew that already.
Covered this, yeah. I do. Well, okay. So obviously, we get to know the people are going to be who they're going to be in the hotel. I think we did. We've talked about them a bit, but essentially, it gets going once there's a cocktail party, and then Maggie Smith is bringing around a tray of the most British lame buffet food, all on little cocktail, like little cherries, like glacé cherries, and like. Hot dog sausages, not hot dog, like mini wieners, if you will, and just the sort of shit that you would turn your nose up at in a party buffet scenario, but was probably the height of sophistication in the 20s, I guess. What do you guys reckon? Was it just shitty British food, or actually this is classy for the 20s?
Well, yeah, it would have been. I mean, that's when it would have kind of been invented. I know now it's a bit, it's like, oh, you're having a party, well, you have to just have some cheese and pineapple on a stick. But I suppose back then it might have been somewhat exotic.
Yeah, everyone just nibbles on sausages, and everyone orders these cocktails. And there's kind of a bit where Poirot sort of gets offered several different cocktails and then asks for some stupid banana liqueur. And, I don't know, Maggie Smith seems to privately think he's a bit of a tossbag. And so she occasionally mentions, like, when he's not around, that he's a pain-in-the-ass Belgium toff guy. And I don't know, Poirot's having his holiday ruined by making it, like, an investigation, really. I think he'd be quite happy to pretend swim and just have cocktails all day. He's always sort of a character of leisure, isn't he? But yeah, everyone, the sing-song they have, where the daughter and the father are playing piano together all happily, and then the actress lady turns up and is basically, oh, I'm sorry, I'm late, and everyone's like, oh, for fuck's sake. And then she tells the stepdaughter to piss off. The adults are hanging out now, and this fucking cuck of a bloke puts up with it. I don't, like, what's he, like, what? How is it not, like, the kids, like, he's like, oh, maybe she could stay up, I mean, she is older now. No, like, that's it. Like, she's the worst.
It's like they've tried to think of every petty thing that she could do. They just made a list and went down, step by step.
Yeah. I mean, the teenage daughter really has it the worst, I think, because everyone else, you know, all know their business opportunities are going to be limited because she's saying no to projects. And like Maggie Smith, she's a bit shirty with. But fundamentally, the teenage daughter is receiving, you know, daily abuse from what is a very healthy relationship with her father. Like, she has a really... Like, this teenager, even though she didn't kill her, if this had continued, she would have murdered her stepmother at some point.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It was just waiting to happen.
So for me, the writing was on the wall for the daughter being the obvious solution, but it's never the person who is most likely to kill. It has to be the most innocuous. So that's the first kind of pro tip I would say when dealing with a murder mystery. Because they're written by writers to keep you guessing, never go for the people they're presenting first of all, as you, the person who did it. It's always the ones you're not really focusing on, isn't it? Would you guys agree?
Yeah, pretty much. And I don't want to, like, toot my own horn or anything, but I kind of knew who did it as soon as kind of, like, the body was discovered in this one.
Yeah, I think...
But going by your rules, it's like, well, who is the least likely now to have done it? Well, the person who had discovered the body, if you know what I mean. Because it had already been done. So then somehow... It must have been them. I didn't quite get how it was done, but I kind of figured out who it was.
For me, the when the penny drops clearest, like you kind of do keep guessing because everyone has alibis. But the man she was having an affair with checked her; she was dead, and there could have been the other person who'd come along as well and clarified. But she was sent back, and there was that clever conversation about, oh, you stay with the body. Please don't fucking stay with the body. And I'll go back. No, what if there's... You know, it's like, oh, but wait, there might be the murderer still around and kill you. Maybe you should go. Yes, I'll go. And then so he gets to stay with the body. So that's a good clue. He doesn't have any obvious motivation to kill her. And it was a little bit suspect him just being alone with her. Because he could have just lied and said she was dead, then killed her. That could have also been a solution at that stage. So... But if you're an experienced sleuther, the writing is there to hint at what it should likely be. Once you've seen a few, you can get the way that writers have to think about it.
The thing I particularly did like was when they got all pricky after they'd been revealed there. You haven't got any evidence. We're going to be the world's biggest douchebags now. What? Excuse me.
Did you say they got all fricky? What's that?
I meant to say pricky, but I think I mumbled.
Oh. Well, that again is another trope of Agatha Christie's things, where people give you some... It's basically Poirot, or whoever the person is, gives you the theory on who it is and suggests some evidence. And the evidence isn't exactly concrete, and it certainly could fall apart in court. So, to be honest, most of the murderers, though they may be looked down upon in the room, don't give it away. Still deny it, and see how it pans out in court. Witnesses might not turn up, evidence might not be there. Even if you're really surprised, like, Christ, Poirot's absolutely nailed it. Stick to your guns, see how it pans out in court. That would be my advice to the murderers in those things. Because it wasn't watertight, really. Even when Poirot comes up with the extra stuff, it's like, well, I don't know, it's not clean cut, is it? I mean, no one saw anything. Circumstantial evidence, really. It's still time to make an escape, right, guys? Could have got away with it.
You still technically could have.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, like,
the only actual evidence was, like, a piece of handwriting, which I'm pretty sure, like, in the 20s probably couldn't hold muster that much.
And, I mean, it's an admission of guilt once you start punching Poirot in the face for being correct. And like Abby said, they become pricks who are clearly guilty, but, at that stage, they could just be mortified that Poirot's come up with quite an elaborate... Like, change... You're reacting to the fact that he's absolutely fucking nailed us here. I will use that emotion of shock to be shocked and appalled that you're accusing me of this. I mean, these handwriting things, this is awful. I don't have an explanation, but... My God, what you're suggesting. I'm sorry, I can't cope with this any longer. I have to go. And then you're out of there. You know, people think it's you. But that's different, isn't it? That's not the same. Being, thought of as a murderer, a lot worse.
Although it's slightly a bit much when you come down, like, when the woman especially comes down like a totally different person.
Yeah. She did transform somewhat. I mean, there's a literal transformation in that she's sort of hiding a tan. I mean, I'd like to come to the contrivances of the murder plan, but I think... You know, the last thing I wanted to say about the bunch of interactions that people all have until we lead up to the reason why an actress gets killed on a beach is I did think the motivations were all there. They're a little bit over the top conveyed. Like, every time someone was being, thwarted by this actress or made to look like a fool or treat... Like, she was such a bitch, it was a bit much. Like, Diana Rigg was deliciously villainous. She could be... Like a classic villain, she could be Cruella de Vil. She's that kind of, over the top caricature of a villain. So I did I kind of enjoyed how over the top it was and how Diana Rigg was such a fucking prick. You know?
Yeah.
So
no, it doesn't quite like her as well.
Yeah, she played heroines more often than in her younger career, didn't she? Like, she's in the Avengers and stuff.
Yeah, that's what she's most famous for.
But, once she turned a corner age-wise, I guess people stopped sympathising and she turned up the bitch volume and it worked for this. I mean, as silly as it is, like, I didn't mind it. So, anyway, some of the incidental things we get are, boat trips are had with people who aren't married. Like, oh, my wife is going off with... Your husband. Oh, that's interesting. And then Maggie Smith blatantly stares at them off going off in a boat mid-sentence to Poirot about some business with his friend not turning up. And she's just, like, slack-jawed, like, oh, I'm distracted. Oh, I mean, there's nothing odd and unusual about those people. There's nothing salacious and obvious about the affair that's clearly going on in front of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And we have various scenes. Like, there's a lot of The couple who did it, or the basic, or, the chap having the affair does the actual murder, and his wife's in on it, and she's going round like a little waif who can't. Oh, the sun is awful. I hate the beach. Why is my shit? Well, she doesn't complain about her husband, but she's basically like, my husband's brought me on the worst holiday ever because I am an albino recluse who hates sand and fun.
My whole thing about those two was a bit like, why? Because you couldn't think why they would be together. At, like, no point did they say, oh, he's rich, I've got for the money, or she's rich, he's married her for the money. You're a bit like, why are these two fucking people together? Get to the plot point.
Yeah, even if the sex is phenomenal, he's having it with someone else, and she's just, like, reading books in the shade while he cavorts on rocks. So, like, and we're supposed to be, like, after the reveal, it's supposed to be that they were deliberately showing up. They're making it obvious, and, like, she tells a bunch of shit to Poirot to kind of give herself alibis and to suggest things about herself, like that she suffers from vertigo, and that, you know, it's basically to have things that are going to trip up the murder later. So it's all there to be. The murderers are set sowing seeds for alibis, but they're also sowing seeds that are going to trip them up and get people to realise, oh shit, it was them. So, I mean, it's functional, but everything's very melodramatic. And, like, the suspect nature of all the affairs is just so blatant. It's just, come on. Somewhat, like, and I think that's one of Poirot's points is, wouldn't an affair... People having an affair don't tend to make a big show of it. They tend to secretly have the affair, not blatantly have the affair. So I think that's a fair point from Poirot. But who wants to talk about the murder? Because the murder is convoluted, to say the least.
So what, it's portrayed as a kind of simple strangling, you know what I mean? Just a kind of a simple, just she was strangled and that's it, by one person kind of thing. But it turns out that actually she was bludgeoned and her body was hidden, her clothes were taken away, and were worn by... the other woman, the wife, who dressed up as her and posed as her dead on the beach, and and then they planned to for her to be discovered by the husband, her lover, who then sent off another witness to go back and inform everyone. But in the meantime, while that's happening, is when they actually perform the murder. And replace the body back to how it was originally supposed to be.
Which is, there's a lot riding on that already. I mean, the husband is kind of hoping that a woman invites herself along on a boat trip for this. Like, she didn't, like the...
Yeah, that was the one thing that was weird. It's like, you have a convenient witness who he didn't ask to come. They just showed up.
Mm.
Yeah, if he needed someone to be there when he discovered the body... so that he could look innocent. But it's like the wife... We should really use their names. But there's the older blonde lady who has her husband there. And they're kind of after Diana Riggs' character. So, you know, they have business they want to persuade her to agree to or star in a film or whatever it was. And she is like, well, I'm going to get a piece of this fucking action man in his little Speedos. And I'm going to go along on a boat trip with him because he's alone this time. Fucking get in there. And that wasn't an invitation, which is what he should have done if he wanted a witness. But that's a small detail. Some of the other aspects that are... Because what you described was really like, okay, so we bludgeon her, put her in the cave, switch the bodies, fake tan, you lie there, witness, switch back, kill her for real, get the diamond. Like, there's all, I don't know, was the diamond a factor? They weren't necessarily... Oh yeah, they're after the diamond as well. I mean, fuck me. But this doesn't involve the sub-scheme of the wife character who's going to commit this murder. She is... She's altered the watch of the teenager she's asked to come on a little painting excursion with her. And if the teenager says, fuck no, bitch, no alibi there. Mm-hmm. So she has to wind a watch, then she has to excuse herself early, run up a cliff, make sure she waves, but also make sure that the teenager is wearing a bathing cap so she doesn't hear the noonday gun, which we didn't even mention. And so she's had to get her witness in place to think the time is wrong. And alter the circumstances so that, you know, it seems at least... I mean, like, the whole watch winding, get the teenager in the water with a bathing cap thing, put the watch back to the correct time, just so people know where you are pretending to be, so you can commit a murder that you need help with. I mean, what the fuck is going on? How are you meant to make this murder work? I mean, they do, because it's a film, or a play, or a book, whatever, but surely it would have been easier to just strangle the woman and then, like, just have a simpler alibi that didn't involve so much trickery. Like, is it that hard? They had the woman alone on a beach, just, you know, strangle her and then let someone else find her?
Maybe. But I suppose, like, if Poirot wasn't there, it would have been fine.
Abby, are you for a second buying their plan was a good one or made sense when it came to fruition?
It was a little bit too contrived.
Mm.
But I think the principle was correct.
It's good to try and create an alibi for yourself. That is a wise move. If you're going to plan a murder, and I don't know, I haven't committed any, as far as anyone knows. But it's like, okay, so if you're going to murder someone, try and have an alibi. But if at any point you get caught altering watches, or like if anyone does stay with you while you wait for help, or like if any element of the plan falls apart, you're going to have to ad-lib a lot of fucking shit. And that's not a good idea. Plus, if you knock out a woman, what's to stop her waking up in the cave grotto and coming to before you plan to strangle her, you know?
Also, once she's prone, why didn't the woman just stove her head in with a rock?
Because strangulation is...
Because mystery.
I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of contrivances. The other thing...
There are, but I think it's still a solid mystery. I think like all the clues are kind of like set out, and they're all suitably kind of obscure clues, like oh, a bottle almost hit me on the head when I was coming around the corner, or like but for some reason I couldn't turn the bath on, so it's like I kind of liked how it was set up. I mean, I thought it was really obvious who it was, but not necessarily how it all happened.
All the jigsaw piece clues that have been set up. So we lay, like, as the investigation unfolds, Poirot interviews people, he finds out that they've all got basically watertight alibis. Whether they, like that the husband smugly says, I don't fucking have an alibi, no fucker was with me, how would you like that? And then Poirot's like, actually, some people did, like, see you. They were having a meeting. They observed you typing, which you claim to have done, so fuck you.
I did like that. That was James Mason's character. And I feel like if I was going to be on the island, that would be me, kind of like oh, it could be me. Maybe it was. What are you going to do about it? This is interesting. This is fun.
The trouble with... Like, it's a funny bit, but... He's the only person who possibly loves this woman, who likes her. This is the husband, like, this is the victim's husband who is going, I could have done the murder.
No.
Oh, sorry, I'm getting my... So, well, who was doing the typing then?
It was... We've been talking about two different people, and the one that, like, didn't have an alibi was... I'm going to remember his character's name. Odell Gardner. Because he was reading under a tree. So he was
Sorry, reading under a tree and typing. You were busy with...
Paper-based.
I did get a bit confused, I'm sorry. It's just because, there are people who are trying to look like murderers, but the people who... I don't have an alibi. Well, cross them off. The murderers will definitely have an alibi. Anyone making a point of the fact that they don't have an alibi is not a murderer, because a murderer would probably plan that shit. At least in this kind of thing. I mean, sometimes murderers just murder. Can't help, you know. Every case is different. But it was nice to see all the elements that were kind of weird, like the noonday gun going off. Is established very early, and you're obviously, well, that's going to play a part. And then some of the clues that should help you guess who's involved are, like, when a woman is deliberately asking, oh, what's the time? I'm going to be late. It's like, when you've got a noonday gun, that'll be a clue. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, there's things to lead you into being able to guess. At the same time, they're so innocuous, like showers and stuff. There's things we can't put together. It feels good when the jigsaw pieces all fit. Once Poirot puts the puzzle together, it is satisfying to see all the parts they put in weren't just worthless information. So in that regard, it is satisfying.
Yeah, unlike a kind of like Sherlock Holmes type mystery, where it kind of revolves around his knowing some obscure fact about something, rather than giving you the clues.
Sure.
If you know what I mean, like it's all here. You can work it out for yourself, more or less.
Well, I would slightly argue, that you can't really. But the pieces that are incident, like the bath thing and the bottle of suntan oil and all this, you can't really guess why those were involved. Like, so a bottle of suntan lotion or whatever is thrown into the sea and it nearly hits a guy, and it also, like, there's witnesses that have contradictory information and all this. There's lots of elements that, like baths running and so forth, that can't be explained by the people who watched it, because I feel like Poirot could have said it was anyone, and as long as he comes up with plausible information to explain it, whoever it is who gets accused will eventually just be guilty and confess. Like, I felt like, well, let's take it again, Poirot. I mean, and first of all, Poirot definitely could have done it himself. He didn't have an alibi, and that never gets resolved. But he could have just gone, so the bottle was vodka who had been drunk by this person and you didn't know that, and then this person was doing this and that explains that, and I noticed that this, and then it basically, he could have gone, bomb 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 bomb, it was you. Ooh, some martini glass pings, and we all know. Am I talking shit here, or could Poirot have pointed the blame on anyone if he'd have come up with a reasonable explanation of all these miscellaneous facts?
I don't think anyone, but there's certainly a good few people he probably could have set up.
There's an element of pulling extra information out of your ass that the viewers didn't get. Like, there is an element of that where we can't put the reasoning together. We might have a suspicion of who could have done it, but we can't actually join all the dots, because they're not actually all there until Poirot starts expounding information. And that kind of crock of shit about, once you spoke Latin and made that comment about your fucking name, or about a name that is this in English, I knew that your real pseudonym name was fucking the Latin for this, which told me that, and, that, fucking, who cares about that? That was bollocks, that Latin name bullshit.
True, but that wasn't crucial. That was just a kind of, like, sealing the deal. Like, well, then... okay, yeah, fair enough. So if you know what I mean. The mystery didn't, like, hinge on that fact.
It was the spark that allegedly helped Poirot go, all of these pieces now fit, because if it was you, then this, this, and that. What we saw couldn't explain all those points being linked without absolute guesswork.
I think you can... If you start from the shower and kind of work your way through it from there, I think it can be done. Someone's obviously lying about the shower. Yeah, and like someone is obviously having a shower for some reason, and the obvious reason to have a shower is to wash something off or to clean something. And then he would have already established where everyone would have said they were, and who would have had alibis, and who would have been where at certain times. So then he could have whittled it down to who could have taken the shower, and then it's like, well, why would they have taken the shower? And I think it could have been kind of worked back from there.
Maybe. I mean, the trouble is, Poirot is written to get it correctly, whereas if you're actually guessing, there's too many ifs and maybes. Like, I just think there could be... I think if you have a stopping point where you get all the clues that Poirot supposedly had, you could basically come up with some excuses for everyone to have fake alibis and tell it any story you want, within reason. I mean, some people have alibis that can't really be altered because of the nature of them, but there's... I don't know. I could have sluice this out a different way. If I could just make up a lot of shit about bottles dropping in seas and people like, oh, you clearly employed a plumber to turn the water off so that you could get this person to take a piss at the wrong time so that they could hear for the noonday gun, be shot in the eye, and fall to where the corpse would be. And then they'd come out of the grotto with your spare sandals and, you know, like, you could do anything if you got long enough.
I suppose that's what the film Clue is kind of parodying then at the end, where it's like, actually, there could be three or four solutions to this, and one of the solutions could be that the, you know, the guy leading the investigation is actually the murderer.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's always an option. I mean, obviously, Poirot would have to be the world's greatest serial killer. The trouble is, he would have to somehow convince people they murdered someone so that they confess and punch him in the face. That's the trick Poirot does. He does the murder, and then Darren Browns them into thinking they did it. Somehow, like, I don't know.
At least he's a detective, like, I mean, a suitable job where you would be around, like, murdered people, unlike, you know, crime writers, yeah, Jessica Fletcher.
Jessica Fletcher definitely commits those murders, because she has ideas for murders in her novels, and, I mean, it's very tasteless to steal from your real-life experiences to make them into murder mysteries. What a bitch. Anyway, yeah, Sherlock Holmes, Poirot, Columbo, fair enough. Although Poirot is on holiday this time, so convenient.
Poirot's always on holiday.
What do you guys make of all the tying into the Moore murders and the diamond that was switched with the wife and all this extra fucking, what felt like, to me, just extra bullshit to tie more characters in?
It was a bit odd, like the beginning bit with the Moore's murder. Like, I did have some satisfaction when it came back later on and it revealed that it was the murderer woman at the beginning as well, and we should have noticed it because we were shown her face, I think.
Is it silhouetted, though? Like, more?
Oh, maybe, I don't know. And there's also, like, a callback to Poirot reading some leaflets, and it blatantly turns the page and there's the murderer's name, like, right in front of you. Little things like that were kind of satisfying. But it was a little bit like, halfway through the film, I did remember, it's like, what about that bit at the beginning? What was that about? Like, that didn't relate to anything. And obviously, it's going to relate to something.
Oh, yeah,
because,
course,
like, there's two strangulations going on.
Yeah. I hate to throw under the bus, but when they did the extreme close-up on the body at the start, the nose fled, and it just ruined it for me.
yeah, every now and again, I feel like I'm going to spoil films by staring at people pretending to be corpses, looking for the eyebrow twitch or the eyes to slightly move. But, you know, I mean, other than just take it again, I mean, you should notice that stuff, but at the same time, we get it, they're dead. Like,
yeah.
Oh, but then that might, if they move slightly, that might make you think it was all the part of the ruse, you know, they weren't really dead and they were actually the one committing murders, you know?
Yeah, my only gripe with that is, like, Poirot just kind of goes like, oh, yes, and I was part of that investigation, and I agreed with the cops. And it's like, well, you might as well have been there then for, like, 30 seconds or something, just to establish that this is part of the mystery.
The other thing, when the police are called it, because Poirot is persuaded by Maggie Smith to think about it and do it himself a minute, because, oh, you're the world's greatest brain in the detective thing. Oh, your gigantic, marvellous mind can solve it, Poirot. Don't get the cops involved in the newspapers. Make sure you've solved it before we fucking call the police in and have it be a big 10-week investigation and it's in the tabloids and my reputation as a hotelier is ruined. But so Poirot, rather unprofessionally, doesn't get the cops involved and muses over it while everyone could potentially still be being murdered. Like, everyone who is potentially a murderer is still free, so let's let them all mingle while I solve it. So, and then to come along and go, right, I have the case solved, tie him up on a boat, take him away. It's like, well, hang on. You've come up with a very convenient explanation that means you're not the murderer, Poirot. And in this case, you're a suspect. You weren't called in after the fact. You knew these people. this actress was probably a bitch to you at some point, like she was to everyone. So I just think maybe it was Poirot.
Mm. Maybe that was like Agatha Christie's secret last book, where it reveals like he's actually a serial that she never got to write or something.
Well, in the last Agatha Christie, it should be that Poirot is murdered, and then Hastings has to like be the one to solve it after years of training under Poirot. And then he probably sees the ghost of Poirot giving him help or something.
Yeah, no, Hastings.
Yeah. It's a shame, because Hastings is he's like the, oh, you simpleton, reading the facts as they lie instead of coming up with elaborate bullshit that actually explains it. Like, I liked Hastings being in the Poirot stories. I guess he would be unnecessary in this, and probably would get the police involved a bit sooner than Poirot did.
Yeah.
But, I just need some clever theories as to how Poirot convinced the people that they were murderers, and then I can solve the case better than the film did. I don't know. I need more things to be stupid alibis and evidences and whatnot. Anyway, I think you're right, Anthony. The main thing is, Agatha Christie was good at having all of the dots joined up in a satisfying way. There was no... Like, anything that's a red herring or is throwing you off... Like, it's a skill in itself to give you enough red herrings and information that keeps you guessing. Like, it's quite difficult to put a plot together that can make you suspect everyone while simultaneously everything will eventually come together in a satisfying way. And I think that's why they're successful, is just the attention to detail. And it's not just fucking you around for 50 minutes until we eventually solve it. It is a well-laced story. It's just a shade, you know, corny, over-the-top, blatant, and occasionally contrived. There's a lot of negative words I can throw at it, but at the end of the day, it's like quite well laced together storytelling.
Yeah, it is. And this was a 2-hour movie, and it really didn't feel like it. I felt like it just kind of breezed by.
I think because there's so many chuckles, whether it's at the stupid hats, costumes, and just the banter, the bitchy banter everyone has, the little relationships people develop, and the sort of pout, whether it's a stroppy fit or a pouty comment or a scandalous action, there's plenty of Jeremy Kyle shit to hang off of with the characters. Like, so the fun comedy nature of it really helps it go by, I think.
And I really like the music.
Not when the people are singing their songs. When the
That was fine.
You mean the sort of... Just
the kind of just upbeat 20s, somewhat jazzy,
summery,
but light,
happy,
yeah,
holiday.
Just all the way through, and I don't know, it just made me, just kept me feeling good.
Yeah, if anything, there wasn't enough dread music for the evil that happened, because the evil was a slightly contrived murder, and then a more murder that wasn't that, you know, relevant to what we saw. But, you know, so the evil element is kind of understated. It's mostly just under the sun, jolly holiday bullshit.
But the relish that he took when he said the name of the film.
It was very odd when he just looked at camera and just, he kind of, the phrase didn't really fit in what he was saying either. It was like he was saying, yeah, it's nice to be on holiday and all that, but basically, think of all the evil that happens under the sun. The world is an evil place, isn't it? And it's like, all right, fuck. No one's dead yet, Poirot. Abby, what do you have any final thoughts and last evaluation before we try and figure out what our metaphor should be?
Yeah, we talked about how they were just sort of like,
I don't know, was there a period in time where we were just like, oh, somebody's dead, that's a shame.
Yeah, that's the mystery element of this.
Oh, that was the one other thing, actually. The way that they spoke every now and again was more like a play, which isn't necessarily critical of plays, because in a play, one of the principal things is to make sure that you are heard and understood. But you don't have to worry about that as much in TV and film. So when they were being very, I am talking now, Now I am talking. Now I am talking. That was a bit, what's happening?
Yeah, it's not a very natural film. But if you compare it to, say, a 50s noir, like back in the 50s and 40s, noir films with the detectives, they're a little stylized, but for the most part, they're sometimes quite hard to follow. Like, there's a lot of names of characters that get mentioned. Like, in this, you can see everyone. I mean, admittedly, we didn't remember the names most of the time. We know the characters. They're broad. They stand out. It's clear who everyone is and what they're doing. But in, like, a noir investigation, they hear information. Like, detectives are finding, like, scraps of paper and learning about characters we've not seen. Sometimes the murderers aren't even in the thing until the end. So a noir film can sometimes, if you sort of aren't really paying attention to all the details, kind of hard to follow. The film Chinatown with Jack Nicholson, that one I'm like, oh, fuck, what's this now? Like, I like the film, but I get lost in these things sometimes. When they're not spelt out, it can be hard for us moronic audience members to follow a murder mystery. If it's all about the little details and they're not emphasised, then you're like, who did what now? Which person has bought the... So what? Why is... What's-his-face with the googly eyes bought the red car in Roger Rabbit? He's bulldozing Toontown because... And what's that going to do with the man who did the projections? What? Does anyone understand Roger Rabbit? I don't follow it. Or Chinatown. Or... Maltese Falcon. They're all too hard.
But not Evil Under the Sun.
Not Evil Under the Sun. Understood it.
Good.
This subtlety. Job done. Exactly. No, I think that's why, though. I'm capable of following a murder mystery, guys. Come on. Even those hard ones with Joaquin Phoenix in, where he's a hippie. What's that one called? Something Inherent Vice? God, that you have to fucking pay attention to everything in that. You have to really fucking... Right. Who is that now?
undermine you, Rich, but yeah. You did forget which one was the husband.
See? That's why you need to spell it out. You need to tell me who's who and what they're doing and why. And that's why they say their lines clearly and one at a time. It's aimed at people who might not be fully, with it. Possibly blind or deaf or stupid.
I have a metaphor. It is a pedalo journey.
Oh. We didn't talk about the pedalos very much. Go on.
What was to say?
Where you start out very like, I'm going to go out on the pedalo, have a little paddle. But then you reach that point where you realise, I'm a little bit tired. But I have to pedal as much again to get back.
And it doesn't. You don't have any momentum as soon as you stop pedaling.
So either you have to, from the beginning, make sure you do a circle so you don't really have to do a turn. Or just accept that you're going to have to put in some extra effort to turn 180 degrees to go back where you came from.
So what does the extra effort mean in terms of the metaphor for this, your feelings on the film?
Well, the journey out is the sort of setup to the film. Where you're like, okay, oh, now she's dead. And the bit going back is where you sort of, you have to sit through all of the red herrings and the, just Poirot being a bit, yes, but then I notice this.
The minutiae of it could be a bit,
And especially with this, because it was a little bit heavy-handed with it. I was a bit like, are we near the shore?
Please, solve it and we could go home. Sure.
So it's not bad necessarily, but on the way back, is that a little bit hard work because you potentially went out a bit further than you should have given how much energy you need to get back?
Okay. I mean, what you're saying is you can still enjoy the film and you can still enjoy a peddler ride. You just have to, know what you're in for, because you could be quite easily fucked off by this film if you're not used to this kind of melodrama.
Mm-hmm.
Formulaic, mystery solving. I think that's fair. Yourself, Anthony, got any metaphor in mind?
Not as yet. I really enjoyed the film. Like you guys said, it was at times, a little bit melodramatic and a bit much, but it was, you know, it was all, for a murder mystery, it was still quite light and funny, and I enjoyed the acting and the characters and the writing. I enjoyed how the mystery panned out. So I don't know, I just really like, I think this is a really kind of solid example of the genre. So I don't, so it's kind of hard thinking of like a metaphor for
it's
just
like a bit of driftwood that is used to bludgeon someone to death.
Good, this, it's a
oak bludgeon murder weapon.
Yeah, it's a nice weekend away on a tropical island. You know, it's escape.
Well.
It's escapism, but it's still exotic.
But you reckon,
and it's just
because you've
pleasant.
You've seen murder mysteries like this. It's like going to a destination you know is good because you've been before. Oh, it's an Agatha Christie. I know what I'm in for. I'll enjoy this again. It'll be new but the same. Can I add to your metaphor, or will you not have it?
No, that's fine. And maybe a little bit better, because I was expecting to be a bit alienated because of how established David Suchet is as Poirot,
yeah.
And thinking like, oh well, a new person, and it's not gonna be. I'm not gonna quite buy it, but I ended up did really buying it.
Yeah, Peter Ustinov is tremendous, so why not? So you and Abby, you've kind of gone on a tropical holiday, and Abby's like, I'm not sure about all this fucking paddling you've got. Like, you've got me to go on this pedalo a lot. I'm going to get sunburn, and I'm going to get tired. I hope you're going to top me up with some cocktails or something.
Actually, thinking about it, I think part of what, like, probably some kind of ultrasonic note going through my head at the time was what? Just, I would be that woman who was like, oh, I've got vertigo, and if I'm in the sun too much, I feel ill and hot. But because I'm actually like that, and she was only playing, it annoyed me.
Yeah, but, you know, so far, so good. If I was to come along on this holiday with you guys, metaphorically, I don't know. I mean, I like the film. It's a working, it works well. It's a good Agatha Christie novel, novel and therefore filmic mystery, and all the parts work. It's a little corny, a little over the top melodramatic, but that's kind of what you expect. It's like complaining that it's sunny in Spain, isn't it? It's like, oh, it's too hot. Well, what did you fucking expect? So
we didn't speculate on the book.
Well, we must have all the way through talking about the film. Surely we're speculating on Well, we haven't directly guessed the book. I mean, the book must be the same, right?
True. I mean, you can't really change the mystery or most of the clues, otherwise it wouldn't work, kind of thing.
There you go, Abby. We've speculated the book is the same as the film, which may not be true. The screenplay may have altered loads. We don't know. Does that tick your box for you?
Thank you.
Yes.
Mm.
I'm going to say the film is like fake suntan lotion or whatever. Not lotion, is it? It's fake suntan oil. I've never used any of the stuff, to be honest. But it's one of those things. If you've got fake tan, it doesn't look real. There's something artificial about people who put it on. It's usually a bit more orange, maybe blotchy, or there's certain parts of you that it doesn't quite look like a real suntan. And so there's a fakeness to it, but it's effective. It still makes, like, if someone who's got fake tan on can still look perkier and more, like, positive and attractive, even though we know it's an illusion. It's like dyeing your hair. It's still, oh, you look younger or happier or more vital or something. Like, even though it's fake, it's still something good about it. So someone who has got on fake tan, if it doesn't look like a fucking Oompa Loompa, if they don't look, like, ridiculous and like David Dickinson, then, yeah, oh, you're looking good. You're looking healthier, you know. But then you kind of, the more you look at the details, you go, oh, there's a lot of blotches, and you've kind of got it on your palms as well. That's not very natural. They see the flaws of what, you know, a real suntan can't have. So, for me, it's like an artificial perk like that, where it's fine, but it's clearly ridiculous. And unreal. But idea still makes a good impact. It's better than just looking like me and Abby look on a daily basis. I don't know what I'm saying. I like people who are pale. There's no problem there, but you know, you get my tortured metaphor, right, guys?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know, you guys are right. It's like a Lilo, Pedalo, holiday, tropical. Yeah, the film's like the film, isn't it?
We've all gone on the same holiday, but we've all come very differently prepared.
Yeah, I've probably bought too many winter clothes and I am too hot. I'll put up with it because Peter Ustinov is here. So yeah, we're all on the same holiday, but everyone experiences holidays differently. We all experience it slightly differently, but none of us are coming back slagging off the holiday, is essentially what we're saying. So no. If you want, watch more of these fucking things with Peter Ustinov in playing Poirot, or indeed pick up any of the other fucking, there's an endless supply of them, but we can't vouch for them all, we just vouch for this one. So there we go, Evil Under the Sun, tick, done, in the can.
Later, shit lords.
How rude.
Okay, then. Bye!
Yeah, that's more like it. Bye, shit lords.
Goodbye.